All right, we're back in the Beit Midrash to continue our studying with chapter 8 of Yoma, the last perek, the last chapter of Masechet, Yoma Tractate, Yom HaKippurim. Last time we left off, thank you, we had a break for a week, right? So we have to remember the last Mishnah that we looked at. At the very end of class, we got to this very, very surprising Mishnah. And the reason why it was so surprising was because of the pregnant woman, not because of the pregnant woman and the fact that we're very compassionate and that we see woven into the fabric of the rabbinic system a very, very decent way of approaching the whole notion of Yom Kippur and pregnancy and how all that works. But it was yet a little surprising to see that there is a selection here that says if she becomes hungry and it's even treif, we're going to allow her to eat something, right? So just to go over that again, the Mishnah begins on 82a2. If you have the Schottenstein edition, it's at the bottom there. You see it, Mishnah? Ubara sheheiricha. So we have a pregnant woman who smelled food and drink and craves it on Yom Kippur. And we feed it to her until she feels relieved. And that is that she feels as though she no longer has any kind of fainting about to happen, or that she doesn't feel sick any longer. Chole, in the case of a sick person, we also add that as a category, ma'achilin oto al pi v'kiin. We feed him on the advice of experts. So we say that he needs to be judged by doctors, but the question is asked in the Rishonim and in other sources, which we did not discuss the last time, why does it say vikiin? Why does it say experts? And not Rofim, and not doctors. So this comes up as a major discussion within the whole halachic framework of making the determination as to really who is allowed to make these decisions. We'll get to that in a moment. The imein sham bikin, but in the case where you have neither of these experts, and if they are doctors, doctors, and if they are other experts, experts. In a case where you have no experts, ma'achilin oto al pi atzmo. You feed him according to his own assessment. Let me just finish the Mishnah. Ad sheyomar dai. Until he says, enough, enough. Okay, question.
It's a question. The word you said, why not rofen and why bikiin? So I was thinking that I don't recall the word rofe. Maybe it's there somewhere, but it's not terribly frequent. Refuah, yes, but rofe is a profession. I don't have any recollection of it appearing anywhere, so maybe that's not, maybe Bikin is good enough. Someone who, they know what they're doing.
We know from the verse rapo yirape.
That's a verb.
Yeah, we know from that verse that rofim are handling matters of briut. So I wouldn't say that it's enough. I would say that there's something to learn from the fact that it uses bikiin. And
okay.
And most of the, you know, the Gemara makes of it something, Rashi makes of it something, so we'll see what's made of it.
Okay.
I want to point out, what Rashi says by way of this pregnant woman. Okay, so if you're following along in the Rashi, the Rashi, of course, is the larger commentary that's towards, I'm now on the Vilna, the actual page of the Vilna. The Rashi is the commentary kind of on the inner gutter. Always Rashi is placed on the inner gutter. Right? So it's like the block that is not the small, small print, closest to the gutter, but the block of text just next to the Gemara language, and it's the seventh wide line in the Rashi down below. Okay? So, matnitin. Let's look at first ubara sheheiricha. Ha'ubar me riach reach tavshil. Rashi makes the point that it's not just the woman smelling this yummy what to eat, but it's the ubar itself, it's the fetus that is smelling this wonderful, sumptuous, scrumptious, you know, it could even be pork roast or stew or some kind of, you know, treif dish. The who mitavelo, and the fetus desires it. The fetus has a desire for it. Ve'im eina ochelet shnehen misukanin. And if she doesn't eat it, the two of them will really fall into danger. So, according to Rashi's sense, first of all, it could be that his understanding really is that the ubar, the fetus, is driving the woman's ta'ava, the woman's desire, but itself, yeah, it's her hunger in this case, but the ubar itself, the fetus itself, he is saying very on the pashat level of his language, and we don't really know what he's thinking all the way, but on the pashat level of the language, he says, the fetus really wants to eat this. Now, what's interesting about that is that he also is well aware of the midrash that he brings on eating kosher in the book of Leviticus. He has this wonderful midrash that says, basically, you're walking by, you know, the candy shop here on the corner of, he doesn't exactly say Lexington and 83rd, but this is basically what he says. You're walking by and you smell bacon. You smell pork. And boy, oh boy, are you now ravenous. You're salivating for it. And what kicks in is the religious discipline that says, I know that I want this. All right, the very human reality, recognizing the human reality of it all. But the religious discipline of, but I know that my sweet Father in heaven commanded me to not eat that, and therefore I'm going to abide by the Torah's law. Right? It's not as though they don't know from non-kosher food. They know from non-kosher food. You know, I'll give you the, for instance, even in commerce, I'll remember which tractate it's in, but the trapper has a trap set up in order to trap the kosher animal so that you can shecht it properly and or sell the kosher animal so that you could ultimately sell it to someone who's going to shecht it properly and eat it, right? But what happens when the non-kosher animal gets trapped in my trap? Am I allowed to eat it? Answer is straightforward. You're not allowed to eat it. Am I allowed to sell it? But according to the Midrash Halakha, which is the hermeneutical approach to the text which makes good use of repetitions in the Torah. So there's a midrash that's standing over here about the Jewish law that says three times in the Torah, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk is mentioned, and therefore I know I can't eat it, I know I can't cook it, and I know I can't what? What's the third element? I can't derive any benefit from it. I have no possibility for hana'ah, meaning I can't make a business out of this. But what about that trapped animal in the trap? Why would the Mishnah even be asking if at the same kind of timing, this midrash halakha, which teaches the law and lets people know how to basically interface with the world of food and the world of animals and the world of kosher and non-kosher, why would this Mishnah even ask? Because it seems that this Mishnah stands to be saying, and if you happen to trap a few incidentally, it really wasn't your main purpose, you're not setting up a business like this, you're really doing it for your own animals, but if you happen on a couple of these, and they're perfectly fine, you're going to be, quote-unquote, living around enough people in the marketplace that if you're already going to sell to the kosher community, you might sell a few to the non. So we see a little bit of space for dealing with the very human reality of mixing with that kind of food. The same way that the Midrash that I told you about from that Rashi quoted in Leviticus about smelling the bacon and having religious discipline makes use of the fact that we're going to walk by these places sometimes and we're going to smell this. Same way that even on Yom Kippur, right, you'd think she wouldn't be anywhere near that kind of experience of the pork roasting, the treif meat roasting. She obviously is near that because the Mishnah here says so. And so the community happens to be mixed in some places. And she happens to smell it. And of course, Rashi in his digs in France happens to live among lots of people.
There's a lot of pork products in French food.
There's a lot.
You know, it's very traditional going back, so I'm sure he really has the same problem.
Yeah, and so what you've got here is a mission that deals with the reality of this kind of, you know, real sense that if I don't get a bite of that, I'm going to lose it. And then what we do is we create what is a step system for getting her the kind of medicine she needs. I'm going to argue that this Mishnah sets her juxtaposed with a chole, because they're seeing in some way the eating of the treif meat the same way they see this sick person needing some nourishment and coming back to a state of, like, not health, but
stabilize
him, right? So we're trying to stabilize her. So I think the Mishnah is presenting this very real reality that way. What's that, Bobby?
Just asking whether medically he doesn't have a point that, you know, if she's hungry, it may mean that the fetus is, you know, needs nourishment.
Oh, good, because that was my next question to Barry.
I'm not a world expert on this, but there definitely are, as you might expect, once you think about evolution, that pregnant women tend to select foods that will be appropriate for what the fetus needs as well as what they need. There's a, if you think about an evolutionary term, so there's a bit of a competition between the mother and the fetus for nutrients. And that's a complicated, again, not thinking in our society, but thinking in evolution. And when that distribution can be challenging to either party, each party may want the lion's share. So there's a lot of evolutionary biology in the relationship between the mother and the fetus, but part of it is some of the cravings are presumably connected to things that would be appropriate, and obviously among them are iron is one of the big things that, because you need enough iron for the baby's blood to
develop. Right, the blood development.
And so on and so forth. But there are other nutrients, obviously, that are important as well.
I mean, I imagine the experience of cravings in here is what Rashi is really pointing to.
What I don't think can happen, though, I don't think the baby has the capacity to smell, because the baby
right.
is encased in fluid, and I don't think that the odors really are volatile.
Right.
So I sort of draw the line that the ability to actually sense aroma, because we associate that with volatility, and that won't be true if you're encased in fluid.
I mean, this is one of those cases, right, where a word for a sense that we have to smell, you know, like we say, you can really sniff out the essence of what's going on, or sniff out the criminal. You know, when they say a detective sniffs out the crime, or the use of that kind of sniffing. So I want to say that Rashi's using the language in as expansive a way. I don't know, again, I don't know if he thought, what's that?
It's a metaphor for sensing.
Yeah, it's a metaphor for sensing, right. And so I don't know if Rashi only used it metaphorically and he thought biologically that something was happening, or he's usually, but I imagine that he's using it metaphorically. Ron?
So I have a problem with this Mishnah because of the condition of Leaviach, of Shehiricha.
Uh-huh.
Because...
What is that word in English?
To smell.
To smell. Lahariach. Hericha is she smelled in past tense.
Because why they differentiate between the sick person who doesn't smell, is just hungry when he's sick.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if she would say, I'm hungry? What the smell condition has to do with anything? If she's hungry, she needs to be fed.
Yeah, there could be an interesting question. I think you're pointing...
I don't know what is the reach condition to her situation.
I think you're pointing to an interesting notion of verbs used in the Mishnah and whether or not the cases are parallel or not, right? So, she smells, ubra shehiricha, ma'achilino ta'ad she'tashiv nasha. The case here is that she smells something, her yearnings, her hunger pangs, her cravings come. And again, I don't want to call it craving so fast because she's actually smelling it, according to the case of the Mishnah. So what leads her on is the smell, hericha. That's a little different than a chole who, on the advice of experts, should eat today because of his illness. It's a little bit of a different case. However, what I would suggest is that the Mishnah is using the case of the chole to categorize the case of the pregnant woman within the larger framework of what we call pikuach nefesh.
So when they talk about the sandal, when they talk about the sandal, isha mu'beret, isha be'erayon,
right. So
she doesn't smell.
Translate for people. When we're talking about the sandal wearing for the pregnant woman, as opposed to feeding her the food that she's smelling. There's no condition. Ah, but there is a condition. There is a condition.
But she's pregnant. That's the condition.
Well, remember that we had a little bit of a debate as to whether or not it was this many days, that many weeks, kind of where she stood on the track of time when it came to feeding the child. We saw by reading in some of the Rishonim that there were more expansive views, and we like those, right? We like the more expansive, less punitive, less worried about specific times. If she was still breastfeeding, then it was a time that we allowed for her to have that. Anyway, I just think the Mishnah is doing an interesting kind of paste together.
I would offer the following medical thought. In the case of the pregnant woman, we're trusting her homeostatic mechanisms to work, meaning her ability to smell and to respond to the smell with a craving represents the way in which she's constructed to respond to her bodily needs. Okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the case of the sick person, we recognize that when people are sick, sometimes they don't even realize it. You know, if you're sick enough, you don't even appreciate that you're dehydrated. You don't have good judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to, in that case, wait for them to kick in the appropriate response. We're going to take those matters into our own hands rather than waiting for them. But in the case of a pregnant woman, we don't really see her as being impaired in
Fine.
Her ability.
I agree 100%, but by the condition of smell, if she would come to you and say, I'm hungry, I need food, would you give her or you would wait until she would smell something? That's my condition. It's a condition that is not logical to the situation of a pregnant woman.
So let me just read something to you in that vein, because I thought that's where you were going. So listen to the comment that Steinsaltz brings down to wrap that all up. He's got the same question that you're asking. A pregnant woman who smelled food, if a pregnant woman smells food and her face shows her craving for it, even if she does not explicitly state that she wants the food, one whispers to her, that it's Yom Kippur, if she's placated by the reminder, nothing further need be done. Okay, we're going to see that later in the text. I just want you to have that in mind. If not, she's fed until she's content, okay, etc. An ill person is fed whatever amount is necessary. We've established according to experts' orders. Okay. Similarly, if any other person smells food and his face shows an absolute craving, according to the Shulchan Aruch, what do you think we do?
Feed him.
How much?
Until he's empty.
No, just a little bit in his mouth, whatever that...
Remember the measurement we came up with?
Was it a diet?
No, remember? Right. A half a cheek with liquid and a half of a...
Date.
Half a date's bowl.
That's a very little bit.
Very little bit. So there are questions about what happens when someone says, I'm hungry, or she says, I'm hungry. Do we consider her having, I smell this, I must have that trace meat, and feed her, and there are some other steps we're going to take according to then how the law gets developed. And if she's smelled it and we consider it to be like she's really got the craving, we parallel to craving, even if she didn't smell it, we go these steps further, because remember the first paragraph, we're going to just read it again. Surprise, surprise, she's going to be able to have the gravy on a spindle, and then she's going to eat an actual part of the fat thereof, and she's going to then have it. I mean, this is all to really satisfy her, because it's obvious to us that we're talking about a different scenario than she's just a little hungry. She's smelled it, and she's attached to it, and she's got to have it, and she's, you know, panicked for her life and the baby's life. And maybe we are too, by the way. Maybe at some level we are too. So all that comes into focus, and again, we have to recall too, case-dependent realities, though we are legislating code. We're still deciding what people can be fed. The sages go immediately to satisfying the deep desire of this woman by saying, Tanu Rabbanan, Ubara Shehi Richa Basar, and we're now on page 8283 for those following along the Schottenstein. So, if a pregnant woman smelled Basar Kodesh or Basar Chazir, either sacrificial meat or Chazir, pork, and craved it, Tochavin lakush barotev. We stick a spindle into the soup in which the prohibited food was cooked. Umanichin la alpiha, and we put it in her mouth. So she's going to suck on that spindle. Im nit yash vadata mutav. If she feels relieved, fine. To im love, and if not, machilino ta rotev atzma. We feed her the soup itself. Ve'im nidyashva data mutav, and if she feels relieved, fine, ve'im love. Machilinota shuman atzmo, we feed her the very fat of the prohibited food. She'en lecha davar she'omed bifnei pikuach nefesh. For there's no thing that stands in the way of saving a life. And obviously we're talking about an extreme situation where she's, you know, obviously just, I think, a little beyond hungry. A little beyond, that smells good. I think what we're really talking about is that we feel as though we really need to get this into her in order to have her come back to us.
But we never get all the way to the meat.
No. Well, what's the implication? In a passage like that, what's the implication? Like, if we take that to the quote-unquote, we won't say in this case, theological extreme, like my teacher, Rabbi, I think I've told you that Rabbi Eddie Feinstein used to say about all of that which you make a claim, take it to the theological extreme and then see if it works. Yeah. But here, I think the next step is the induction, the logical place to go is that you're going to get to the meat. Now, I know it doesn't say it, and you could make the argument that since it doesn't say it, you should say that's forbidden.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that they're stopping at a very what? Clear point.
Right, and you know that you can make the claim just the other way, you know? You could make the claim the other way. that obviously if you have steps 1, 2, 3, why shouldn't you have 4?
Because we always make limits somewhere, and looks to yeah. like they've drawn the line where they feel the line needs to be drawn.
Look, it's a good rabbinic hermeneutical kind of thing.
But then it says, "For nothing stands in the way."
Right, nothing. Outside of what? May avodah zarah, nothing stands in the way of life, saving life. Chutz me avodah zarah, idol worship, v'gilui arayot, illicit relationships, in other words, sex crimes, ushfichut damim, and murder. So, yeah, in that sense, Bill, you're right. It gives you the extreme and leaves you that space. There's nothing that you're going to stop.
So I can't resist trying to go back the other way just to make the case. And that this right now is a craving, right? Which we're moving down the line. So
yeah.
We really haven't established that her life is in danger or the fetus's life is in danger.
Correct. That's the answer you could give.
Right.
But I do believe based on, and this is the point, that based on this reasoning, which ends with, these are the only three things that you possibly give up a life for, that the case must be that we really are worried for her life.
But I'm just saying, in the case of this woman, a pregnant woman who has a craving that starts from smelling, that's very different than somebody at death's door who
absolutely
is protein malnourished.
We've had those passages where it says, kol modin, all admit, all agree that craving, I would say, so if we brought up the case of just the craving, that's probably not it. But in this case, we get it to the level of pikuach nefesh. We get it to the level of saving her life, and we see that they're on. Now, why, just as a piece of background information, why do we allow her, say it is life, right? Yet there's still a mitzvah, la'anot et nafshatecha. There's still a mitzvah to afflict your souls. 5 times it's written to afflict your souls. We know that this is a major, major component of Yom Kippur. Why do we allow that? Why would we allow anything to be transgressed and don't give up your life for it? Well, except these three. What we're really talking about in terms of allowing to be transgressed are these mitzvot, especially the mitzvot that you have to do positively. In other words, the positive nature of afflicting your soul until what? Until you die? No. Because we're going to get the reason we have mitzvot in the Gemara text in a little bit. It's going to use the pasuk that says, Chai behem, you should live through doing mitzvot. It's going to pull out those two words from the Torah and say, our entire system of doing all this, of course, really, really is intensely all about living. But there are these three, shall we call them cardinal sins, just for the sake of it for a minute, to get our minds thinking about other groups maybe of sins we know about. Leave that on the back burner. We're going to look at some of other materials about groups of sins. But these three have a very special place in the canon of sins. And you can't transgress. You can't commit these crimes. You have to pay with your life. And thusly, the turn here is not about a case of a pregnant woman right now, in terms of now the narrative of this part of the Gemara. It's not about a pregnant woman, and it's not about a chole. It's not about a sick person. Now it's about all of us. And now, the end of this brisa, though we were talking about the pregnant woman and what we feed her when she's on the cusp of death and when she, or is it a craving and we don't, now we're into the bigger issue, the philosophical issue of pikuach nefesh. And we're going to take that turn, and we're going to take that turn seriously, and instead of making it about these cases specifically, we're now going to be back into this major question on Yom Kippur about any of our sins that we have committed, whether or not we should have paid with our life for them, the answer being no, unless you're talking about these three major sins for which you pay with your life. And then what the ancient worshiper might be thinking about, to add a complexity into that philosophical question, is, so then why are you making me, quote-unquote, put myself on the altar and say, God, I offer my soul to you. I offer this Yom Kippur Korban, this Yom Kippur offering, in place of me, because I know I'm a sinner, all these sins I've done, and God is mechaper, and God atones for all the sins that we committed. But if it's only natural to be human and to have sinned all these sins and to live through them and to not give up our lives for this, the question could be on a ritual level, why do I bring myself as quote-unquote close to death as Yom Kippur really allows for or creates by way of the ritual? The Kohen Gadol goes into the Holy of Holies close to death. I remove myself from all bodily reality, all physical reality. It's angelic on the one hand, holy, but it's close to death on the other. It's a touch towards death, according to sources. So, philosophically, this moves us into a core sense of what all these rituals are really trying to help us relate to. On this Yom Kippur day, it's putting into focus some of the practices and the notion of how close we come to life without sin, life with sin, life and death itself. And this exploration here, though it parallels the exploration of transgress all sins but don't transgress these three cardinal ones, it parallels it, the discussion in Sanhedrin, which is the tractate about the court system and civil law and criminal law and damages, property and body damages to body, let's say corporal law and capital crimes, right? Self-defense, all that in here. But that discussion that's in here appears here in this next small section of our Gemara in a very different context. And so we don't want to forget that it's part of our ritual, procedural, criminal law. We won't forget that when we read it. But we're not going to read it as only ritual, criminal law and law about self-defense and law about the three sins in this way of thinking about crime and punishment. We're going to now think about it in terms of Yom Kippur and the individual experience of Yom Kippur, and the ritual approach that we take, and what that means internally and philosophically.
They bring here the issue of Shfichut Damim. The case of Rodef, is it fall, does it fall in the concept of Shfichut Damim?
Well, you're asking about certain laws, again, that I'm making mention of. Ron's making reference to the Rodef, which means one who pursues another to kill another. And then when you rise up and you attack the attacker and kill the attacker, this is what's called Din Rodef. So when I kill a murderer and I'm exempt, does this...
Is Shfichut Damim.
Right. Does this, defending this other person, which is really killing in self-defense, though
I'm killing the third party in self-defense.
It's killing a third party. The third party, no, kills in self-defense instead of the one being chased. The third party doesn't. That's not included here.
It's not.
That's outside the framework for a moment.
So Shfichut Damim, if I kill somebody, it's not
Shfichut Damim. The case is murder.
Pure murder.
You are to kill this person. And that is, and we know that's the case because of again, the hypertext, the hyperlink, is back to page 74 in this tractate. So when we read this, we're going to be informed by this already and know what this said, and there's one or two little more parts in here than are in here. And the case that you're asking about, Ron, is exactly that case where this Rav is confronted with the notion that he must go and kill someone, and then he is killed instead. Okay?
Is there any other instance where they mention being allowed to eat pork? I mean, I find it so completely antithetical.
You know, let's go back to that at a different point,
okay. Because
I really want to push forward in the Gemara right now, but we will keep the question in our parking lot about eating treif.
Okay?
Because it takes a whole long different set of halachic courses to talk about when we actually see treif. The short answer is that if you're going to survive and you have to make critical decisions, right, then it goes right back to our text here. Pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh. And the only things that you should really pay with your life for are these three. So it is kind of wrapped up in there, Bobby. But over here, it wants to get into these three principles, and it wants to derive where these specific kind of exceptions come from. So it's going to ask the typical question, Avodah Zarah Minalan. So idolatry, from where do we learn this? Now, what's the assumption of the question? The assumption of the question is that you know exactly what's meant by what? Avodah Zarah. You obviously know what idol worship is. If it's asking you or telling you that you can't commit idol worship. So let's ask ourselves, what do we think the general reading public or the general listening public thought that idol worship was in the context of the Mishnah, in the context of Talmudic times? Because that's a question that has to stand. You can't ask a question about Avodah Zarah, about idol worship, unless you really have a conception of what that is. So, what's that?
Home idols, like the
So, between Bobby's answer, Rob, and your answer, I think we got it. Home idols and what the Goyim are doing. You know, the reality is pretty decent answer. Pretty decent answer. Covers the, very specifics, right? In essence, both parts of the second commandment. Don't have other gods beside me, and make no image of gods or anything under my heavens, right? So no little statuettes, no little physical idols, no representations, and worship only happens the way I say worship should happen.
Yeah, but that's the second commandment, is the recognition of God, that there were other gods at the time.
Ah, so
that is, you say there are, but you work for me,
right? So we don't necessarily have to be stuck on a belief that monotheism only accepted that there's only one possible God. We never really said that. We accepted that people defined their either patron gods that were more ethereal than statuette-esque, or that they named their statues and called them gods, or that they considered certain kinds of places to be divine, like an asherah, like a plant, a special plant, or a special kind of stone heap. We don't necessarily say that there aren't other gods out there. No. We say that Michamocha Ba'ilim Adonai. Who is like you among the gods? In the end, theologically, we can say that Jewish theology developed to include a conception that God's oneness, and this gets manifest the most in Kabbalistic and mystical literature, God's oneness includes all manifestations of language and reality that exist in what we know as the world. But simple pshat of Torah and Tanakh and the ancient worlds of rabbinic understandings of the Romans praying to their gods or the Greeks praying to theirs, I don't think that they would deny that those people believed that those were gods. And the reality stands that we have in our worship services, we have in our tefillah, some very, very straightforward conceptions of a world that's filled with multiple gods. And the Haftarot, for sure, express it. Because what I'll add to the two parts of the definition we came up with is all of what the rabbis at least hope, if not the Jewish people, understood at that point about Avodah Zarah. And that is that they included having strange sexual practices in sacred, or for the rabbis, profane, but sacred attachment to one another and to gods as being part of the foreign worship, the Avodah Zarah that they defined. And there, and if you look at the basics of Ezekiel's prophecy and Hosea's prophecy, and look at the kind of relationship that you're to have with God, and that you shouldn't prostitute yourselves to others, there's a double entendre here. It's metaphorical. Don't have loyalty to these other gods. But it's also a commentary on what some of the practices, cultic practices, especially in ancient times, not sure in temple times, though you know what they say about Rome and their orgies. So there were probably some type of at least service of divine priests, perhaps, that included some very promiscuous behavior. So when we
not Jewish,
right? So when we think about what I'm saying is when we think about Avodah Zarah,
part of Judaism.
What's that?
Because it existed that there were other religions that did that, you know, and pagan things that did it. What is it?
Well, what I'm saying is that it falls under the banner of Avodah Zarah.
Right.
That we ask the question, what is Avodah Zarah? Oftentimes people will leave it at it's praying to an idol or having an idol or having smaller idols, and that they see it as worship to those idols and offerings to those idols. The point is that the ritual life and the practices surrounding those gods, inclusive of promiscuity, sexual promiscuity, are in the consciousness of those relating to what was being asked of, say, an Israelite in this case, a Hebrew, a Jew, if they're talking about thou shalt not do this and even pay with one's life, right? So you could see someone, in the very simplest sense, being asked to put food down at the feet of such and such idol, right? That sounds like Avodah Zarah to us. You also have to consider, and again, whether this happened or not exactly this way, I'm not suggesting it, but that you should get involved with this absolute sexual debauchery when it comes to this foreign worship, which, if you think about it, is you know, could be for any given kind of, call them pagan or call them just foreign worship, a very interesting way of expressing one's sense of connection with a god, searching for quote-unquote religious experience. The Gemara and our tradition is very much against such practices. And not only about sexual crimes do they say pay with your life, but they're talking about any kind of promiscuity like that that would be connected to the world of idol worship. And it's just important to remember how many times in the Bible, in the Tanakh, that these kinds of metaphors are used for the activity of what happens, including Baal Peor, including in the Torah itself, when you're talking about sexual relationships with the Midianites, maybe it was towards their god that they were really asking for this kind of relationship, not just for mixing with the Canaanites and marrying one another. So we keep that in mind in the background when it comes to defining Avodah Zarah. You know, what I found interesting in looking at the depth and the conception, the depth about the conception of idolatry, is that the Greek term for idol, which is used in translations in the Septuagint, is idoin, E-I-D-O-I-O-N. And it's effectively a term of derision, meaning that this god is a god that has no power. Insubstantiality and falsehood. Totally false. Idol worship might have included eating food that was dedicated to gods, not just offering food, but eating it. And that call to resist pagan pressure for Jews was obviously a late pressure thrust upon Jews. If we're to look at the book of Daniel and understand its context as a later book within the canon, where the king's food is denied by Daniel and the servants, and they ask for an alternative. The food is shunned because it's food that relates not only to the king, but to the king's golden image. Whereas neighbors used images, statues, statuettes, symbols to describe the gods with whom they had relationships and who they worshipped, Deuteronomy 4, 12 through 18 explains that God chooses to make himself known through words, and that we are to relate to God through words. And thus, the worship we have, no wonder, becomes liturgical and full of words, as opposed to the rejection, as in Exodus 32 to 34, where the golden calves are utterly rejected, and the feeling that God's presence exists in the world through material statues, even of gold, cannot be seen as Jewish at all. So, the final note that I'll read, because I was thinking about this as I was reading some other Jewish sources from the medieval era, is sometimes we often say that the worship of such and such material items, such and such, is idolatry. If we put it into perspective as having, let's say, prominence of place in our heart's desire or what we consider to be divine, say beyond what conception of God we have. Now, someone can thrust science into the space of divinity. Is that idolatry if I trust and believe in science more than I believe in God and the Lord and the mitzvot, or something more concrete, like if I worship money. That seems to be a pretty modern trope. We take that into, we sometimes use it in the slavery conception, and we sometimes use it in the idolatry conception, right? We are no longer slaves to Pharaoh, but we're slaves to these things. We've all heard that kind of use at the Pesach Seder. Well, there's also the question of whether or not those things become idol worship versus slavery, and are we idolizing them, and is that Avodah Zarah now to hold those things in such high esteem, put those things on the pedestal, make those the statues around which we offer our lives, our time, this and that. Well, this kind of discussion is hinted at in the Psalms, where the wealthy are said to only trust their money and despise some of the kind of mitzvot that God has set into motion to create social justice frameworks, or if you don't like that term, because in modernity it's taken on one or two specific things, that there's a sense that you can create a space for wealth or hold wealth or riches in a higher esteem than the Lord God. It was said more specifically in the New Testament as a critique of some of what was potentially happening in the temple.
William Jennings Bryan was a gold speech. William Jennings Bryan
share
gave
it.
A very famous speech called the Gross of Gold speech. Denigrating the worship of lucre.
I just saw a portrait of William Jennings Bryan in Washington. I was in Washington for 2 days. I snuck into the National Portrait Gallery for a while. Saw some fantastic work. So I was looking at him. They have one of him individually, and one he's hanging with a group of contemporaries. Very interesting. So this kind of warning really happened as I said, I just want to find the quotes. Oh, greed is idolatry here. So, just for some Jewish take on carrying out the theme that was already in Psalms, Colossians 3:5 says explicitly greed is idolatry. Ephesians 5:5, the greedy person is an idolater. Jewish preoccupation with food laws and circumcision may even be called greed about this world and thus idolatry, according to some who understand what's being said in Romans and Philippians. Matthew also says about greed and idolatry, but we have to remember that this was really in Psalm 62, rich are not to set their heart as the spiritual organ of love and devotion, seeming to indicate that it was really tied to God, that God should be the focus of your devotion, not these riches. But I would say, and my note is, the question still asked, was this simply a reaction to an abuse of temple economics, which we know the rabbis were upset about, in addition to the early writers of Christianity? And is it Avodah Zarah to put money into such high esteem? Is it enslavement to money, or is it simply corruption and you need to have more moral outlook on monetary policy and the use of funds and et cetera, et cetera? And we have to keep Avodah Zarah more to the majority of times that in the Tanakh it's defined as worshiping other gods, crediting them with power of creation, natural world, control of natural world, and that their worship then creates all kinds of strange, whether it's cultic practice, sacrificial practice, prostitution type of practice in the name of the God. That's more the Avodah Zarah we're talking about. So I think that's more the Avodah Zarah we're talking about over here in the Gemara, and they still want to know, from where do we derive it? From where do we derive it? Where do we derive what? So now that we understand what Avodah Zarah is, where do we derive that you're to be, you're to give up your life versus have anything to do with Avodah Zarah? Rabbi Eliezer Omer, so I'm on that left-hand column of 82A3. So this is a braita. D'tanya, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, it says in reference to the verse, and he brings up the verse, V'ahavta et Adonai l'hecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol me'odecha. He's now dealing with the verse that we say in the Shema, the central verse in the Shema. Im ne'mar b'chol nafshecha. If it's stated with all your soul, what does that sound like, nafshecha? That's your life. Lama ne'mar b'chol me'odecha. Why is it even necessary to state with all your resources? It's obviously projects an understanding that me'odecha is your resources, which, again, we're just going to take on face value right now and not get into how they translated ma'od, which is what, in general?
Very.
Very.
It's an adjective.
It's an adjective. But they translate that as resources.
I don't think it's resources at all.
Right. I knew we were going to get an argument from the...
Only in Hebrew you can do that me'odecha. In English you cannot make that as from very...
That's right. That's right.
A
so...
noun, but in,
They do it.
The whole melody, it's like if there's an intent, very intensity.
That's right.
Of intent. It's not just I'm giving my life, it's like I want to do it.
Right. I would have thought it was more about intent than actual physical resources. If I was to say like, you know, inherently what I thought ma'od was. Yeah, but it's considered resources. So,
b'chol... What's your veriness? All your... enthusiasm, all your...
Right. I mean, I think you could make the argument that way, but the Midrash sees it as b'chol nafshecha is your life, b'chol me'odecha is your resources, your money, b'chol levavcha, that's your heart, right?
Arbe me'od is the me'odecha. It's not...
b'chol nafshecha or b'chol me'odecha. So why do I need the extra if I already have
it's an attitude.
Your heart and your soul? Why do I get this me'odecha? Because it says about resources. So here's the limud. Lama ne'amar b'chol nafshecha. And why is it stated with all your soul? Im yesh lecha adam shegufo chaviv alav mimamono. So it says nafshecha because we know that some people, if you have a person whose body is more precious to him than his money, then what? Lechach ne'amar b'chol nafshecha. I have to be willing to give up my life and not just my money.
Like Jack Benny. Your money
and
your life.
That's what I was thinking. I'm thinking. Let me think.
V'im yesh lecha adam shemamono chaviv alav migufo. And if you have a person whose money is more precious to him than his body, lechach ne'amar v'chol me'odecha. Therefore, it's stated with all your resources. So what do we have? We have the notion that everything is for God. Everything. Whether it's your money or your life, and in this case, the life is really only about the context being the Avodah Zarah question. If someone tells me I have to commit idol worship, I have to give it up. What do I have to give up? My life. I also have to give up my money. I got to give it all up. Now, they leave it there. The scriptural sources for the exceptions of illicit relations now. Gilui arayo to shvichu damim. They bunch the two together now. Minala. How do I know I also pay with my life and I don't transgress these sexual transgressions nor murder? D'tanya, for it's taught in the Braita. Rabbi Omer, Rabbi says, ki kasher yakumi shal reihu uretzacho nefesh kein hadavar hazeh. Scripture states concerning this. What's a situation of rape of a young girl, for like a man who rises up against his fellow and murders him, so is this. So just like when a man rises up to murder, so too is this offense so grave that you pay with your life this rape of this young girl. And so, v'chi ma inyan mamadnu merotzeach le'na'ara u'me'orasa. Now, what point do we learn about a betrothed na'ara from the laws of a murder? In other words, the situation was not only was she a young woman, but she was actually betrothed to be married. Ela harezek balalamed, that comes to teach. This mention of murder came to teach something about this betrothed na'ara, v'nim tzalamed, but in fact it was found to be the subject of a teaching as well. And if you look down, it says, the Torah is juxtaposing the subjects of murder and betrothed na'ara for the purpose of establishing a hekesh, meaning that they come together to be basically the same limud between the two, to teach something, though, about each subject, and that is to derive a different law about a betrothed na'ara from the laws of a murder, and to derive a law about a murderer from the laws of the betrothed na'ara. As Rebbe now explains, here it is, ma na'ara mera sanitan la'atzila b'nafsho, just as with regard to a betrothed na'ara, the law is that she may be saved from rape at the cost of her pursuer's life. She may be saved from that at the cost of her pursuer's life. Right? So what does that sound like, Ron?
It's like Rodev, but it's like you need Rodev. His wife to stop, and if you continue to do it.
Nah, we don't have that here. Afrod seyach lahatzilo benafsho. So too, with respect to a would-be murderer, the law is that the intended victim may be saved at the cost of the would-be murderer's life. Rebbe now explains that the laws of a murderer teach about a betrothed na'ara. Ma rotzeach yeh hareg ba'al yavor, just as someone told that he must commit murder, should allow himself to be killed and not transgress the prohibition against murder. Af na'ara hame'orasa yeh hareg al yavor. So too, in the case of a betrothed na'ara, one must allow himself to be killed and not transgress the prohibition against adultery. So, with the na'ara, the case is, you might have thought the rodef, that I could, as a third party, kill the person who's the pursuer, right, self-defense, and only in that case. But now I've learned that with someone actually going to commit rape, I can rise up and kill that person too, and not it doesn't it's not accounted it's not accounted to me for murder. And and also, just like someone is told that he must commit murder, you can't commit murder and you should be killed. So too, if you're told to commit rape, which is what's called gilui arayot, illicit sexual crime, you shall not transgress, and you pay with your life. That's a strong statement about three very specific things that, again, if I now pan out for a second and remember the context I'm learning this all in, very important about Yom Kippur Day. Bobby, before we get there, did you have something?
Rape, is that the same thing as illicit sex?
Well, when it says illicit sex,
is it only
it's rape? Talking about rape. And it's talking about a sex crime, right? They're using rape as the paradigmatic
sex crime. It's not consensual, out-of-wedlock sex. That's what I'm asking.
Well,
gilui aralot is illegal sex. Means that, you know,
for whom? I mean, we get into very technical questions when it comes to consensual out-of-wedlock sex. And then who is really the criminal party in such a situation in rabbinical legislation? That's a very different case.
So
in this case, we're talking, you could say specific, but it's talking about specifically matters that you know as the potential transgressor are a crime. So yes, about the rape, yes, also about anything I know that falls under the category of sexual crime. Now, to talk about, the context and remind ourselves, over here and over here, yes, you could say it's all about the legislation and it's self-defense legislation, and it's, but it's bringing you three different cardinal sins, that you don't transgress and you pay for with your life. And if you think about those three, there's a deep connection to those three and what the Yom Kippur Day is all about. Starting first with Avodah Zarah, you're there to do the pure worship of Adonai your God for a full day, and you want to be sure that your worship is pure, and you have an entire avodah service, and you go through every detail. And in the ancient rite of Yom Kippur, that was the time that you reread exactly how the ritual should be done, and you knew that this is exactly the two goats, and this is exactly where to, and this one took the Azazel, and so we made this specifically about the worship of our God. We outlined the ritual, and we're very careful to make that ritual the specific ritual we either do or that we remember by the time of the rabbis, right? The rabbis include the Avodah service in our Yom Kippur liturgy through the Gemara, saying that's what we're going to recall. And they even, for the Kohen Gadol, who had it, let's say, memorized, went through the entire ritual. Very careful we are about doing the worship as is prescribed and not idol worship or foreign worship of any kind. Right? This was not a day to be creative. This was a specific way of doing business. So you have that. Then you have this notion of illicit relations. Well, you're going to have no relations this day. Right? You're going to be pure of body in the sense that you will not have even consensual sexual relations. Now, in the best of relationships, thank God, consensual relations are at the core of intimacy, right? But even those relationships that are somehow sanctified, there's also like all kinds of push and pull, not to get graphic, with consent, how that relationship unfolds, in the name of what is the sexual relationship really unfolding and happening. These are kinds of matters of the human sexuality. You are to focus again, and this has been my conception with what curriculum is offered us here, you're to focus again on the purity of your relationship, of your intimate relationship. And thirdly, with murder, here's an interesting kind of twist or concept that I thought of, and maybe you have other conceptions of where murder fits in. I find this to be an interesting kind of question after reading this. Were we sending the Kohen Gadol into a massive fire pit? Remember that he's going into the Holy of Holies and we think that he's going to die? Right? Right. But are we willing to send somebody else to his death in order to expiate ourselves, in order to have the kapara? And how far are you willing to go? And I think that that ritual of the Kohen and the Kodesh HaKodeshim and of the potential possibility even that exists, that you would see somebody pay with his life and then celebrate his coming out, right? The liturgy at the end of the Avodah, they made a yontif for the Kohen Gadol, Vayetayu. It's a fantastic celebration of his return to us, right? That is the affirmation of a people that would not send some kind of human sacrifice into the middle. The Akedah plays right into it, Bob, which is my next example of it. We wouldn't have a God who would demand the child's sacrifice.
And that's clearer than what might happen to the Kohen Gadol, who was doing this very willingly as part of his lofty.
Yeah,
condition.
But I think there's
a strange fire.
I guess I made the first time the connection between the message of the Akedah and the message of the Kohen Gadol. And I had not seen that before until I thought about the inclusion of this brisa in this part of the Gemara.
Two more. when Moses goes on the mountain, he's taking a chance also, standing in front of Elohim Nora. The best word that describes it is the word in Hebrew it's the Nora, which is the greatest fear. So that's what Moses is doing twice. And then Lehavdil, Jesus Christ, the same concept. You die for the others and resurrect.
Oh, by the way, over there with Jesus of Nazareth, you do have them believing that someone should die for you.
That's what I'm saying.
As opposed to our tradition.
Yeah, but with our tradition, it's done willingly. Moses is putting himself...
We never allow that to be done willingly. That's what makes them so distinct and apart. That there's death. By the way, you take that and fast forward it too. Remember our learning in the summer with the Zohar. The notion that Shimon Bar Yochai dies a regular human death, and as a hero of Torah and as a charioteer into the heavens and as a someone who knows the soul world, doesn't die for our sins and doesn't pay with his life, if you will. Dies a regular death is set against the world of Christendom telling us that we should accept the death of a Savior as a religious kind of framework to think about human life and sin. And Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah take on grand importance over time, especially in the Middle Ages.
Moses is the ultimate Kohen Gadol, the ultimate. Going up to on the mountain.
I like that notion. And the asceticism, by the way, that is denied, even though he goes up on the mountain, to come back down and to be part of the people twice,
exactly,
is not only now the rejection of death and sacrifice of the human, of the adult or the child, but the notion that the adult must function in this worldliness of our spiritual reality and not just the ascetic reality of the mountain. So that adds yet another dimension.
Yitro is a good example this week. It is, the Ten Commandments include idolatry that we just had, murder that
yes.
we just had,
yes.
fundamental. But what about the rape of the Na'ara? Is that anywhere in the Ten Commandments?
Well, you could say... You could say that the relationship between your sense of... what woman you have a right to is functionally at the last part of the Ten Commandments.
And
it's really thy neighbor's wife. And it's all about putting your sexual tendencies into check at that part of the Ten Commandments. So you could say that you could find all three of these in those commandments.
But is the Na'ara a wife?
That is a specific case, and for the rabbis, that Na'ara is Me'orasa. She is betrothed in the framework of the Torah system. And the idea here is, when it comes to Gilui Arayot, you might have thought, since she's not a wife, that she has this status, and that maybe by your doing so, you would, who knows what, take her as a wife, or she's free to consort with, right? But even then, she's not a wife yet. She's not an Eshet Ish. Even then, it's illicit. Even then, it's a crime. And even then, be killed and do not commit that crime. Very strong statement.
Now, idol worship is... Would it be acceptable to pretend to, under coercion, to worship?
There's always one in the crowd. Pretending and
conversos?
Yeah. So this is a really big trope in the world of conversos, in the world of crypto Jews, in that kind of literature and the kind of narrative that's coming out about those Jews. So I have a friend named Ronnie Perilous, who's the director of Sephardic, I think he's called the director of Sephardic Studies, but his professorship, his chair, may be different than what I'm saying. But he's written recently on some narratives from these folks, and a little bit of that attitude of I wasn't doing it with truth in my heart was right. So that's what we're talking about. So this was an approach that halachic authorities dealt with, and in order to trace that back into the literature of the sages, you can sometimes see in certain places everything from as simple an approach as if you said the bracha but you didn't have kavanah, you didn't have intentionality, was it like saying it at all? So the equal and opposite side of that. In other words, do you say when you say things, do they have to really hold the meaning that you're saying in order for them to be real, right? So I can learn from the fact that I would have to repeat some blessing if I didn't say it with kavanah. Only certain blessings, by the way, that I had to repeat. But since I didn't mean it, since I didn't have intentionality, I needed to say it again because my words are essential, right? So just saying empty words, perhaps it's a way to deal with the very human factor that you could imagine happening if someone asked you with the Avodah Zarah one, you know, I want you to say right now that Baal is the main god. Right? Okay, Baal is the main god. Now, can we do some business?
You know? It depends on what that word love means, right? I mean, that's the scriptural basis. You love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, mm-hmm. with all the resources or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that word love, so is it possible to love your God but to publicly do something else that that protects your life, or that you have the ongoing capacity to love your God and serve
right.
your God?
Exactly. I mean, you could really apply the verse that they do in order to really learn where all this is from. And that is the one that's, I don't think it's quoted here, but as I mentioned, it is quoted here, and that is Chai Behem.
So, I mean, we got Queen Esther, sort of interesting in this regard.
Yeah, I mean, so many interesting tales of who puts themselves into what scenarios and what situations.
Yeah.
Sarah in Egypt.
Yeah, I was going to say, you got Sarah.
I mean, right, these are the kinds of questions that we have to ask ourselves. So what kind of either pretending or scheme or saying it but not meaning it.
The pre-revelation. But,
Regardless. It's really true that is an element here of the very human factor, particularly with Avodah Zarah,
also,
and maybe with the relationships.
Yeah, but also, I think it's interesting, the women versus the men, and the fact that the women are given more leeway here because they're viewed as passive in these processes, so I think that sort of plays into this as well.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Which women, Sarah and Esther?
Well, the issue of if the Nara is not held accountable for participating in the illicit act, I'm just saying, with good reason, but you could imagine someone taking a different view of that
right.
even though she's being forced into it, she still shouldn't do it, even at the expense.
By the way, there's some who want to argue that she's judged as being complicit and that she didn't do enough to stop it, right? So that trope comes out and it's not down. Much like in today's discussions about this whole notion of, you know, is the victim attracting attention to herself and what role does victimhood play?
So we're back to that, what I said at the beginning, which is, what does that word love mean?
Yeah, so here's how in ancient philology, the first level of philology, we think that le'ahov is not a matter of emotional love. We think that it means loyalty, and that to be ahuv is to be completely loyal, in the way that a soldier is loyal to a general, in a way that a man is now loyal to a wife. that you're combined of, now you're one flesh, and there is real loyalty. Because what is the, at least the sex act with Adam v'Chava, the verb that's used is yada, carnal knowledge of one another. And there is, though, a use of ahav in a little bit of a way.
David v'Yonatan.
That's a little later. That's in prophetic literature.
Don't we equate idolatry with adultery?
The first is Isaac and Rebecca.
Yeah, first. And the first is, I was just getting back to Torah, is Isaac and Rebecca. And
the first love actually is Abraham. It's God saying that he knows that Abraham loves.
Correct, and that's the point. So after you recognize that the first love between people is over here, the verb is really used with divine loyalty before it's used in any kind of sense of people and their relationships and that level of emotional kind of love that may be there. Getting back to your question, how do we use le'ahov then? Zahavta et Hashem Elokecha. You have to remain loyal. Couple that with the drush that's in Sanhedrin about these kinds of mitzvot and thinking about how we're going to really define these and am I going to really pay with my life? Chai behem becomes the operative phrase. And then in order to, whether it's the later period of say this Shema twice a day and act on ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, or know that that's the goal I'm going for before liturgy happens and before I say Shema twice a day, that we really still hold in highest esteem, pikuach nefesh, the saving of all life, saving of life when we can, the preservation of life when we can. Just before we end tonight, think about the three sins named here, and then think for a second about another collection of sins that you might be familiar with. So, at least at first, when I first encountered this, I always knew this as a very Christian concept. There were seven deadly sins.
Like a Jeopardy question.
Gluttony was the one that
I remember.
Seven deadly sins.
Greed, sloth.
There you go. So we're gonna review these seven deadly sins. And there's a very interesting art connection because they were featured greatly in the work of Hieronymus Bosch, who's known
among many others,
but he focused a lot on them.
Bruegel too, yes, particularly Northern European.
Yeah,
so 15th century brought out that there are seven that are enumerated as pride, covetousness, lust, envy, gluttony, anger, and sloth.
So not greed, covetousness, but not greed.
Covetousness is, you could say, is
similar, but not the same.
Now, it says in Mishle, so the question is there a Hebrew root for these seven? So I went searching.
You mean a Hebrew analogy?
Are the roots of these... First of all, seven as a number was really interesting to me already. And so I started doing a little searching. Do we have a list other than these three as to be, you know, very, very serious sins that you should avoid at all costs? I'm not saying that you should be killed.
The Noahide Code is seven.
Well, Noahide Code is also seven, right. So when it comes with the rest of the world, we have seven laws. The Noahide Code. Nice that you mentioned that, because I happen to just have that list to read, if we were going to mention it. So wait, where's that list? Where's that list? I thought I had that list. Yeah, there's seven Noahide laws. You shouldn't murder. You should have court system. Don't steal. But that's not these seven.
So these seven. They're Christian.
Who
Correct, but where are they written? In what were they written?
So they're kind of concept of seven deadly sins that the church fathers...
No, but what year and in what document?
I don't know where the first time they're mentioned in the Christian world is.
So what's the proof text for them?
Well, that's what I went searching for. Is there some type of hint of these seven deadly sins in Jewish texts?
Right, so I just wondered when they came up in Christian texts.
That would be an interesting research question that I did not get to.
Okay. So by the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I think...
concrete?
Right. Mm-hmm. I think, though, that it's early, you know, in the early centuries of CE in church, in patristic literature. Okay, so the notion of seven. Mishlei says in chapter 6, verse 16, Shesh Hena Saneh Hashem, six things that God hates, Vesheva Toavot Nafsho, and seven that are an abomination to God. And Mishlei, being a wisdom literature book, is all about the behavior of human beings. Very human book, and very shared wisdom literature, a shared sense of humanity with other traditions. So if you think about the seven being mentioned there, and you take then an Agadah in Brachot, there's a passage in Talmud Brachot that says, Shmona sibot amita al ha'adam hem. There are eight reasons a person dies. Achat mechamat chet Adam arishon. One, let's set aside and say it's because of the sin of Adam. You eat what God tells you not to eat. Whatever Adam's true sin was, that's one reason why. But then, v'sheva mechamat sheva roshei averot, and seven reasons for the seven really big transgressions that cause all other sins. And here it is, so it's in our Gemara. Vehem, hata'ava, desire for gratification. Hakina, jealousy. Hagava, pride. Shehua kavod, that's also honor, like searching after honor. Kilut, or kilua, that is stinginess, shehu ein hara, that brings on the evil eye. Hazanut, illicit sexual encounters, shehu yetzer hara. Vesina habriot, that is the evil inclination at work and hatred expressed towards others. That is the Yetzer Hara, that's the evil inclination. Sinat Habriot, hatred of others, internal hatred of others, this is yet another one. Uvatela, and sloth. So we're very close. This is from Talmud Brachot, page 4. Did you find the original?
It was a monk. The 4th century monk, Evagrius Ponticus, is credited.
There's our answer.
And it was supposedly because of the monks had a tendency to do these things, so this was to remind the monks what to avoid.
Very nice. Early Musar literature.
But who knows where he got it from, right?
Well,
it's from the Talmud.
Yeah.
Right. And we know that there's exchange here.
Sure.
Back and forth. And so my point is that on the one hand, there's these three that inherently we talked about now, having the connection to the Yom Kippur they do and having the relationship to the Yom Kippur that we know. And that, in my mind, this is how the curriculum works, I believe. Hypertext, three sins. Let me think about seven sins. Question. Wait a minute. Am I too influenced by the Christian world and the art I know about the seven major sins, or is this us? Hypertext, back my way. We have seven mentioned in Mishlei. And we have seven outlined in Brachot already. And so perhaps by listing sins in a group of three, I'm also reminded of, you know, the list of a group of seven. And if I'm alive during this time, and it works that way, for sure it's much easier in our time, because we already know Mishnah Avot, Pirkei Avot, which lists these seven in groups of three, plus it has a Mishnah about one, the seventh one, and it all comes flowing back as soon as you read this, that it was broken down further in Mishnah Avot, which we don't have time to get to, but trust me, it's all in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which is the latest strata of rabbinic literature, probably after the Gemara is finished. Mishnah Avot is really capped and finished and tied with a bow. So this notion in Yom Kippur that we're to think about these areas, we're to have experiences in the ritual way in these kinds of spaces of afflicting our souls becomes very deeply ethical about sin and what sins we're just not going to go there with, we have to pay with our lives with. And also think about these character traits that we have to refine. If this is for everyone or not for everyone who's sitting there and thinking, are there any other lists of sins? Not everyone's going to work that way. But here we are in the Beit Midrash, studying the rabbi's curricula, knowing that they're listing things for us. Oh, where else does a list exist? And we should go, and we should understand that we're also going to, for the year, have to take an accounting of what it means when we talk about our desires and our envy and pride and honor and stinginess and sexual relationships and hatred and where that plays in and our sloth. So at least let's not be lazy.
You know, if you take away all these seven, what's left?
Well, we have
Yeah, I can't answer exactly how many, but I hear your question. I hear your question. How the Al-Chetz then expanded, we're going to do towards the end of the learning. Yeah, yeah, maybe. Maybe it's an interesting exercise if we categorize them like that. Good learning.
Thank you.
Just
you.
The
winner.